You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you. You're listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. I'm your host and WFHB News Director, Wes Martin. For this special Christmas Day broadcast, we'll be listening to some of our best reporting from 2017. Joe Crawford kicks off this edition of the Daily Local News with a report from April on the last-minute stop to the City of Bloomington's annexation efforts.
Special interests, including the Cook Group, played a significant role in a surprise undermining of the City of Bloomington's annexation plans. That's according to officials at City Hall and the State House today. A last-minute effort to kill the controversial annexation succeeded on Friday night, as state lawmakers approved a budget bill with language that makes it illegal for the city to proceed with its plans for at least 5 years. The measure only affects Bloomington and will not prevent any other cities from annexing properties. Before the legislature approved the bill on Friday, State Representative Matt Pierce of Bloomington confronted the bill's author, Representative Tim Brown of Crawfordsville.
Who requested that we put this provision in the budget bill that had not passed either house?
Again, it was brought by some citizens and also through one of the other state representatives that represents Monroe County. And some of the businesses of Monroe County, citizens and state representatives and businesses.
Well, that's kind of curious because I hadn't had anybody approach me about putting a provision in the budget bill. Did it occur to you maybe to check in with the person who represents most of the city of Bloomington? Get some feedback on what people are thinking?
Brown did not respond to that question. Pierce went on to say that he had concerns himself about the city's annexation plan, but he said Brown's last-minute legislative maneuver was undemocratic.
And you know that these provisions don't get put in the budget bill by just anybody. I mean, just how many times have we all said, oh man, I really want this if I could just get it in the budget? And 9 times out of 10, that doesn't happen. So I'm just really more concerned about the process. What does it really take to get it in the budget? How much influence and power do you have to have? What do you have to do to get that power and influence?
One of the property owners who would have been most affected by the annexation was the Cook Group, the largest manufacturer in Monroe County. The company expected to pay about $500,000 a year in additional property taxes if the annexation was approved. The communications director at the City of Bloomington, Mary Catherine Carmichael, says the city had been in negotiations with the medical device manufacturer prior to Friday's vote.
We had sat down with representatives from Cook, including Steve Ferguson, and said, how can we make this okay for you and okay for us? And those discussions, again, were aborted because they chose not to discuss, but just to go ahead up to the legislature and get it shut down.
The headquarters for the Cook Group on Daniels Way was slated to be annexed into the city under a plan announced in February by Mayor John Hamilton. State Representative Jeff Ellington, who supported the last-minute budget bill passage, says he did hear others at the State House talking about Cook's concerns.
I'd heard in the hallways that, yeah, Cook was trying to protect their infrastructure out there. But for me, it's about protecting my district.
Ellington represents part of the area that had been proposed for annexation. The plan would have resulted in higher taxes for many of the roughly 15,000 people who would have been annexed into the city under the mayor's plan. In exchange, those taxpayers would have received services from the city, including police, trash, and fire. Ellington was an opponent of the city's annexation plan for months, and he made multiple attempts this year to pass legislation that would undermine the proposal.
I've tried to help push a bill that had been filed that dealt with annexation in the Senate. If I remember right, it did not make it out of committee. The second opportunity was I sent some amendments over to another bill in the Senate. One made it in committee, And then on the second, so on the Senate floor, it got nullified by another amendment. So then I also put in, my own amendment together in the House and attached it to a bill which I thought was germane. It was ruled not germane, so I had to withdraw it. So I've been talking about this issue at the State House since first week of February.
Ellington was one of the property owners who would have paid higher taxes under the mayor's plan. His business, J.R. Ellington Tree Experts, is located in an area that had been slated for annexation. Among other affected groups, Monroe County officials have voiced relief about the canceled plans in recent days. The county budget was set to take a major hit if the annexation went through. But County Council member Jeff McKim says the issue is not settled.
A lot of it has to do with the provision of services, you know, about fire protection and police protection. And that's the sort of thing we need to gather additional data about. Is the city subsidizing parts of the county in the provision of services or vice versa? Clearly, there is a concern, like I said, or the city wouldn't have brought the proposal forward.
McKim says he would like the state to overhaul its laws regarding annexation. Representatives of Cook Group did not agree to an interview this afternoon, but the chairman of the board at the company, Steve Ferguson, issued a statement explaining his opposition to annexation. Ferguson states, quote, "Many residents throughout the county, including many Cook employees, spoke up and made it clear to their local and state legislators that they were surprised and dismayed by the annexation proposal. They asked for help," unquote.
That was former WFHB News Director Joe Crawford bringing us a report from April about the city of Bloomington's annexation attempt that was halted in a last-minute amendment tied to the state's budget. Crawford brings us this next report from March about the volunteer-run addiction program being forced out of the Monroe County Jail.
Reporting for WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford. For the past 7 years, Christopher Haynes has led meetings in a special dorm at the Monroe County Jail. The dorm is set aside for inmates with addiction issues. Haynes spends an hour a week talking with inmates on subjects including meditation and spirituality. Participants have described activities ranging from the dissection of Leonard Cohen lyrics to discussions based on interviews with monks to frank conversations about their spiritual views. Haynes is a volunteer, as are the inmates. In a conversation this morning, he pointed out that inmates choose to participate in the addiction program, even though it means they live with less privacy in an area of the building without windows.
In spite of the fact that dorm is less desirable and considerably so in significant ways, these men volunteer for that. They're told what it's like, what they're moving into, and they still want it because it gives them not only access to the programming, but it gives them a 24-hour communal environment with other people who are interested in bettering themselves, which they report is, you know, not at all the environment that is found in the other jail blocks.
The program that takes place in that dorm is called Addicts in Recovery, or AIR, and it's facilitated by a number of volunteers like Haynes. The program is operated by New Leaf, New Life, a nonprofit organization with a mission to promote better conditions in the jail, reduce recidivism, and help inmates successfully re-enter society. And although Haynes and others are still eager volunteers, the program appears to be ending, at least for now.
As people have been leaving, no new inmates have been coming into that dorm now for a few weeks, so their numbers have already dwindled to maybe half of the full dozen limit there.
The reason for the end of the Addicts in Recovery dorm is complicated, and it goes back to 2014, when the state legislature passed laws attempting to reform the criminal justice system in Indiana. But basically, the volunteer-run program is being replaced. There's currently only one area of the county jail building where an outside agency is allowed to sort of run things. There are other places where organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous and New Leaf, New Life and others can hold meetings or do programming, but there's just one housing area set aside for exactly that purpose, and that's the area that has been, until now, space for the Addicts in Recovery dorm. But starting next month, the area will house a related but very different program facilitated by Centerstone, a much larger organization that provides community-based mental health and addiction services. The director of grants and specialized services at Centerstone, Jennifer Fillmore, says her organization's work at the jail is funded through a state initiative called Recovery Works, which began after the passage of criminal justice reforms.
Most of the time, if someone is in the jail, you can't go in there and see them. If they have Medicaid, for example, you can't get reimbursed for that service. But with Recovery Works, since it's focused on criminal justice population, they've allowed providers to go in and provide services before the person is released back into the community. So Centerstone has been partnering with the Sheriff's Department, and we've been going into the jail, and we've been completing assessments 30 days before someone is released back into the community. And we've been doing some life skills case management to prepare that person for that transition to the community. 30 days is a very limited time when you're talking about folks that have serious and persistent substance use and mental health disorders, who are often homeless, and have a whole slew of other problems that they're trying to deal with. So the Division of Mental Health and Addiction recognized that this wasn't long enough, and they put out a request for proposals that went to all the sheriff's offices throughout the state of Indiana. Because we were already working so closely with the Monroe County Jail, the sheriff approached us, and we jointly wrote an application saying, we would love to be able to start offering services to people 90 days before release. We feel like that's more time, you know, it allows for more preparation for the person when they're being released into the community.
That new state-funded program is taking the physical space currently used by New Leaf, New Life to run the Addicts in Recovery dorm. And there are some important differences between those two programs. For one, the old program served exclusively inmates who volunteered for it. There was no tangible incentive beyond the programming itself. But according to Fillmore, participants in the new program could be there because they're court ordered.
Can they self-refer? Yes. But they could also be referred by the judge or probation if they violated probation, or, you know, prosecutor or public defender's office.
For Haynes, that distinction is important. He notes the significance of having a group of inmates who have chosen to seek help. He also points out that the Addicts in Recovery dorm served many county jail inmates who were preparing to ship off to state prisons, places where, by the way, drug use is often a major issue. The new Centerstone program will serve a different population, inmates that are about to be released back into the community.
It serves a very different need, and I understand that there is a need for the kind of program that's envisioned there.
Fillmore from Centerstone and the jail administrator, Sam Crow, both emphasized today that the new program will be, quote, evidence-based, and that the facilitators will be licensed and accredited. When asked whether the Addicts in Recovery dorm over the years has been a success, Crow said he simply didn't have enough numbers.
That's one of those things that I can't answer because they don't provide me with statistics on it. And that's one of the problems that we've had with that program, is that we don't have enough information on it. You know, they've been doing it for several years, and I just can't get statistics. The prior administration wasn't able to get statistics. So I really can't tell you how it's performing.
While Crow says he doesn't have the numbers, letters of support from inmates would suggest that at least some do very much believe in the program. In one letter provided to WFHB, an inmate writes that, quote, though the faces and interests of the air dorm inmates change, the desire for the inmates to introspectively look at their lives and express themselves in a creative way has never changed, unquote. Haynes says he sees a need for the Centerstone program, but he also thinks there's a reason to have a volunteer-run program like the air dorm.
The inmates in the air dorm very much appreciate the nature of the program they have had. They especially appreciate that programs are being led by volunteers, by people that are there out of a sense of service and love and, you know, not professional obligation. And that means a great deal to them.
To be clear, New Leaf, New Life as an organization will continue to operate within the Monroe County Jail. They'll continue to run transition programs, enrichment programs, and others. Crow and Fillmore both said they would look for ways to incorporate New Leaf, New Life into the new Centerstone program. For WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
You're listening to the best of the daily local news on WFHB. I'm WFHB News Director Wes Martin. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. Support for WFHB also comes from Lauren Wood Builders. Lauren Wood Builders is a family-owned company that sources local material and local craftsmen to minimize environmental impact and sustain community. More information is available at laurenwoodbuilders.com. In this next piece, correspondent Jared Dill brings us a report from April about a Bloomington landlord.
Indiana University Credit Union is pursuing foreclosure action against several properties owned by Jeff Jones, owner of the property management company Pendragon Properties. The lawsuits, 9 in total, affect Pendragon locations around the city of Bloomington. The court filings allege that Jones is behind on his mortgage payments, as well as owing large sums of money in unpaid property taxes. One filing showed almost $50,000 in unpaid property taxes on a building valued at around $800,000. All of the cases were filed at the end of February. Pendragon manages dozens of rental houses around Bloomington, as well as several apartment complexes. The apartments are predominantly mid to low cost. The defendants named in the cases include the City of Bloomington Utilities Department, as well as the Department of Housing and Neighborhood Development. Additionally, a long list of unnamed tenants were named as defendants. Court papers were served to those tenants in March. We spoke with City Attorney Chris Wheeler regarding why the city was named as a defendant in the case. He says the city has several outstanding judgments against Jones, as well as a lien against his properties for unpaid sewer bills. This constitutes a financial interest for the city in the outcome of the case.
The City of Bloomington Utilities is also named in quite a few of those. The only reason that the city is named is that the city owns various judgments against the owner of the real estate. So when a foreclosure occurs, the bank or financial institution that is holding the mortgage is obligated to notify everybody who has any kind of interest in the real estate that this foreclosure is occurring, whether it be a financial interest. So, well, they're all financial interests, but they are in varying degrees. So all of the unknown tenants are named because they have an ownership interest in the real estate to a degree. They have a right to be in the unit or the home. Some of these are houses, some are apartment complexes.
The judgments, Wheeler said, stemmed from previous cases brought against Jones under Title 16 of the Bloomington Municipal Code. Title 16 covers inspection and maintenance requirements for rental units in Bloomington, over which Housing and Neighborhood Development has jurisdiction. Tenants of Pendragon Properties were named in the case because, as residents with current lease agreements, they too have a financial interest in the outcome of the case. The serving of court documents to large numbers of tenants in early March set off rumors on social media of mass evictions at Pendragon Apartments. We have been unable to confirm that any tenants have been evicted as a direct result of the foreclosure proceedings. It is possible that the court documents served to tenants were mistakenly interpreted as indicators that an eviction would soon follow. This is attorney Mike Carman, who represents Jones and Pendragon. He says there's no reason anyone would be evicted at this stage of the proceedings.
If that's happened, it's not been involving, Jeff uses another attorney for some matters, but I'm not aware, and it would be a surprise anybody's been evicted as a result of these proceedings, because there's no way to do that. I mean, the bank, when they file the foreclosure, often names known tenants, or usually they list them as unknown tenants or occupants, but I'm sure credit union did on these, but those are not eviction orders, and there'd have to be a court hearing, and they, you know, their request on the foreclosure ultimately would be to terminate the lease. But that's, depending on what happens, could be, that could be months and months down the road if that happens at all. So I'm actually not aware there's been any evictions or an attempt to do any evictions as part of this.
The unnamed tenants were served through the mail by the Monroe County Sheriff's Department. Carmen says that, from the tenants' perspective, nothing is likely to change for several months while the case works its way through the court. There is a possibility that the case could be resolved without a change in ownership, in which case tenants would be unaffected. In most markets, maintaining a revenue stream from existing tenants is a smarter financial move than evicting them once ownership of the property changes hands. Jeff Jones and Pendragon have a history of conflicts with their own tenants, as well as with Hand and the city. We spoke with Adam Scouten of the Bloomington Solidarity Network, an activist organization that, among other activities, assists tenants in handling conflicts with landlords. He says most of the complaints levied at Pendragon are for unresolved maintenance issues in aging houses and apartment buildings.
Other problems that we've seen mostly revolve around, you know, broken appliances, just generally apartments being run down, broken windows not being repaired, and, you know, the sort of rain and the elements getting into people's properties. The list goes on and on. It's typically around maintenance things because the buildings are in such poor shape by and large. What usually happens is people have no recourse but to withhold rent, and then he moves to evict them. And that's pretty much standard business practice for them.
Landlords are still obligated to uphold their lease agreements while foreclosure proceedings are underway. There are several services available in Bloomington for tenants who are having issues with their landlords. In addition to the Solidarity Network, Bloomington residents can contact Housing and Neighborhood Development for help. Free legal advice for low-income Hoosiers is available through the local office of Indiana Legal Services, and IU students can contact Student Legal Services for advice. As of this broadcast, Jones's attorneys have been granted a motion to extend the time available to prepare for the case. We made repeated calls to Jeff Jones for comment, but were unable to speak with him. We also spoke with a representative of IU Credit Union who declined to comment on any aspect of the case. For WFHB News, I'm Jared Dill.
You're listening to the Daily Local News, Best of 2017. In this next piece, I interview Adrian Matika, who was just named Indiana State Poet Laureate.
Okay, so this is a poem called Emily Dickinson featuring basketball and EPMD. And everyone knows who Emily Dickinson is, or should, but EPMD was a great, great and overlooked rap group in the 1980s. I read poetry out here, spindling the spindles of happenstance, its M-dashery like the closed eye of a winking man used for a record needle. I love when the laces of my suede kicks come undone like the best laid plans. And when I crouch to tie those boys up, I love savoring the shy glory of my girl's skirted knee, her sticked hemp branching like the feathered stems in a blue boa she would never wear. There are too many boas in this world, and the first feather in their garish elegance, America, home of lovers and EPMD breaking car speakers like high school curfew since 1988, someplace when I loved summer, the dash from one hoop to another, a stray kitten chewing on a moth in the Zionsville bleachers before we fed him a hamburger, and somebody's business as usual cassette untangling bit by bit like laughs. I think, well, right now I just sit and marvel at the fact someone picked me to be poet laureate of the state of Indiana. It's such an incredible honor to be chosen when we have so many brilliant poets in our state. And they, you know, I'm thinking right now of my colleagues here at IU, you know, Ross Gay, who's wonderful, and Kathy Bowman, and my wife Stacy, who was a brilliant poet before I met her. So it's not just home team bias, you know. We're really fortunate here to have poets who give and support the art of poetry. So with all of these other options and all of these other really terrific writers to choose from, it's pretty overwhelming that they chose me. Like many, many poets I started writing to try to impress someone. But then later on, I realized that this was a very vital means of communication and expression. And when I say later on, I mean like a couple weeks later. It didn't take very long for me to get hooked on the idea of trying to create music with words. Well, I listen to music when I'm writing. For me, there's not a lot of gap between the kind of rhythmic intention in a poem and the rhythmic intention in a song. I mean, you know, it might lay itself out in a song with a drum beat. But we have stressed and unstressed syllables in poems. So there are ways that the two things sort of mirror one another in action and intention. And besides that, I mean, the English language has the potential to sound so wonderful. There are different kinds of programming I'm trying to set up in order to put poems in front of Hoosiers. You know, there's so many poetry readers and poetry writers in our state, and I hope I'm going to be in communication with them. And then there are also a lot of other people who don't read poems, and I would love for them to look up and see a poem on a billboard, you know, or on a bus, or reach in their pocket and find a poem and not even be expecting to find that there. I don't know how that works, but I want to put poems in places they aren't ordinarily found. So the Poet Laureate position is housed with the Indiana Arts Commission, but it's a state position. So at some point I get to go and read it in the state house while the legislature is in session. I don't know if I'm going to be reading my poem about EPMD while I'm there for them or not. I don't know what I'm going to read, but, you know, so it's housed with the IAC and I get to work with them pretty directly. And they have a mandate from the Department of Education to try to do work and, you know, to introduce art into the public schools. So I'm really excited about being able to go and work with young writers. You know, I was encouraged while I was in high school to write. And so I used to write short stories and things like that, but nobody ever saw them because they were terrible. And then when I came to IU, I found poems. I mean, it was pretty immediate. I think I was 19. And that was the first time I'd ever tried to write a poem was when I come here. Yeah. I wrote it because I was trying to impress a girl. So the whole plan was to share it mm-hmm. with her and nobody else. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrible, terrible poem. I actually have it still someplace. I saw it in one of my notebooks when I was moving maybe about 7 or 8 years ago. So I know it exists in my house still somewhere. I'm not trying very hard to find it, but it was a ghastly poem. Well, I mean, I had the idea that a poem is essentially all of the biggest words you can think of in, you know, order that makes some of them rhyme. That was my idea of what poems were. So there's just this, you know, all this polysyllabic language. It doesn't make any sense at all. But in some ways, I was actually not that far off in terms of the idea of poetry, which is, and this is someone else's quote, and I can't remember who, the best words in the best order. It's just that my best words weren't good enough, and my order was completely wrong. But the idea is right, you know, that we take the language around us and reshape it in ways that create something new. You know, probably 20 or 25 drafts of before the poem is ready, and it takes about a year for me to finish a poem. But I take breaks from the poem, so I'll put it away for a month, try to learn some new things, come back and look at it again, and I do that. I mean, my most recent book is called Map to the Stars, and it took me 6 years to write the book. So some of the poems were being revised still in 2016, but I'd started them back in 2010. Right. The book before that is called The Big Smoke, and it took 8 years to write. And so there are poems that were written, you know, at the beginning of that 8 years that were still being questioned and revised right before the book was coming out. So, I mean, I think there's a rush because we have a very immediate culture right now. And, you know, 140, I guess it's more than 140 characters on Twitter now, but, you know, there's a sort of immediacy to thought and idea, but poems aren't tweets. You know, poems are poems, and they take as long as they need to offer themselves to the world. And any kind of trying to push that ahead or speed it up is just going to do harm. So, you know, at some point I learned that and just settled in. I'm like, all right, cool. I might not have any poems to share with magazines right now or any new poems to share with the world, not because I'm not writing, but because they're not ready yet. And I'm not going to make them ready just to, you know, to have something.
That was Indiana State Poet Laureate Adrian Matika. That interview, which aired in December, is available, as are all other stories, on WFHB's website, wfhb.org. You've been listening to the best of the Daily Local News on WFHB. I'm your host and WFHB News Director, Wes Martin, bringing you this special Christmas Day broadcast. Thank you for listening.